25 minutes before the hour from Gasoline Alley to the Yoakum Mansion. And this is monitor Al Capstaff, not Cap, at the drawing boards of Radio Central. Well, if any modern-day phenomenon is really a New World phenomenon, it's the gold mine of certain publishers, the comic book. But the question that keeps on cropping up all the time is one that's sure to start a lively debate. Are the comic books always comic? For an answer to this poser and some thoughtfully prepared comment on this popular New World subject, Monitor tosses the question to the scholars. The place, the University of Chicago, and the guide to our answers, Professor Edward W. Rosenheim, Jr.
One of the most striking things about today's college professor is his eagerness to worry about things which, traditionally speaking, are none of his business. Any institution or habit or difficulty which seems to him to be an important part of the new world of our time is likely to come in for careful professorial examination. We have an example of this today, for we've gathered to talk about, of all things, comic books. Comic books is an important modern fact, an important problem, and a genuine challenge. Two professors have joined us. One is R. Richard Wohl, a sociologist who has given a great deal of study to comic books and their effect. Another is Charles Wegner, who as a philosopher and teacher watches popular culture almost as carefully as he does the scholarly journals. To add an authoritative, non-academic touch, we have with us as well Mr. Bernard Weisberg, attorney and general counsel for the Illinois Division of the American Civil Liberties Union, who has devoted much time recently to the legal implications of controlling what people read. Well, Mr. Weisberg, I suppose the reason that we are justified in discussing comic books at all is that they have struck people as a real problem in the American scene today.
I think what we're seeing is that a great many people are disturbed about what's in these comic books. They feel that there's a great deal of horror, violence, not just what we lawyers have traditionally thought about as obscenity. And I might suggest parenthetically that it would be helpful to borrow the phrase of an Englishman who called these things uncomic non-books.
Mr. Wegner, do you feel that the sources of apprehension are about what Mr. Weisberg has described?
Well, of course, but I also think that it's worth mentioning as a beginning that some people, perhaps less vocal, are concerned also about the tastelessness of these things as literature or as an art form, in addition to their possibilities for moral corruption or subversive intent or something like that.
Well, to get right out of the realm of conjecture and to consult Mr. Wohl's real authoritative study of these things, do the statistics bear out the fact that comic books are important in the American scene, Mr. Wohl?
People snap up these non-comic, non-books like hotcakes. We buy about 1 billion copies a year. They cost the country $100 million, and the $100 million seems to be spent very cheerfully. To put this in relation with some of our other expenditures for printed matter, this $100 million spent on comic books is four times what all American public libraries spend for books, and is four times as much as we spend for all books except textbooks. Comic books, whether they are a problem or not, are certainly a prominent feature of the American scene, and nearly everybody reads them.
I wonder if they're a purely modern feature of the American scene. One often hears that the equivalents of comic books have always been with us and the problem is not a new one. But would it be possible, do you suppose, to establish whether or not this is a uniquely modern problem?
Well, we've had versions of books that occupy approximately the same standard of taste and the same acceptability to go back only about 50 years. Much of what you hear about comic books today was then addressed to the dime or nickel novel. The same kind of argument. Even before then, to novels and romances, to ballads, to Punch and Judy shows.
They were all accused of being violent, obscene, and immoral at one time or
and
another.
And subversive.
I'd like to suggest that we're talking here not only about comic books, but we're really talking about all kinds of printed matter that get to children. The agitation for some sort of control technique on quarter paper-backed books, for example, is in many ways much more significant than the agitation about comic books, illustrated books as such.
As a matter of fact, the whole field is so vast that we did decide before we began our discussion that we would try to bracket in on the comic book in particular, but I'm glad you reminded us that many of the problems that will emerge apply equally well to these other areas you've discussed. Has the apprehension about literature of this sort always been with us historically? Are there examples of people who objected strongly in the past to literature of various kinds?
Well, I think there is something rather amusing, perhaps not exactly the same sort of thing, but I believe it was in the 40s that Wordsworth wrote a sonnet about illustrated books and papers in which he complained that things were coming to a pretty pass when people would be looking at pictures rather than reading anything. This, of course, has a wider application than comic books, but it indicates this sort of concern for the corruption of the public imagination, the public taste, and the public morals through the medium of visual material is not something confined to the last 5 or 10 years.
As some Minnesota law professors recently put it, maybe what we're worried about is not only why Johnny can't read, but what will happen if he does.
Well, is it only a question of Johnny? Who is the audience for comic books? A quarter of all high school graduates in the country read them. 16% of all college graduates read them. And surprisingly for our prejudices, 12 in every 100 American teachers read them. It's by no means kid stuff.
But perhaps we ought now to address ourselves the fundamental question of what's wrong with comic books. It looks as though they're here to stay, or it looks at least as though they're a terribly important part of the American scene. Now, what's all the fuss about? What are the things that are wrong with them?
Well, I think to state a widely held view, many people feel that comic books hurt children, that in some cases they may actually suggest to them some ways of misbehaving. Many legislative committees that have studied the question have toyed with the conclusion that comic books may be a significant cause of juvenile delinquency.
May I say, get in a plug here for my problem about taste? I think it's interesting in this connection because what is really the basis of concern there, it would seem to me, is not that the something positive is being done to the child, that he's being given ideas about what he might do and so on, but rather that his horizon is severely limited. That is, if he is confined to this sort of literature, he will never discover the joys of really significant and tasteful presentation of plots and ideas and artistic materials of every kind. Now, that is a negative thing, and that perhaps is what is really disturbing about these figures, about how many people who are not children read these things, because it means that they've not gotten off the childish diet.
Well, we've moved from what people say to what at least one of you actually feels is wrong about the comic books. How about you, Mr. Wall? Do you think a genuine case can be made against them?
Well, on many grounds, and I agree with Mr. Wagoner that the ground of taste is the one that appeals to me most. But to put the matter more strictly, I doubt if presently we could prove with social science or any other science that comic books specifically cause juvenile delinquency, in the sense that we can't hold comic books constant aside from television, movies, other types of popular magazines and newspapers in which crime or violence or any of the other objectionable features occur probably as often and as graphically as they do in comic books themselves. I'm inclined to think myself that while a potential juvenile delinquent may get some very interesting ideas from reading a comic book, the comic book is no more than a symptom of the deeper underlying causes that may turn a child into delinquency, and that simple exposure to a comic book won't make him a delinquent necessarily.
You mean it might conceivably make him slightly more efficient delinquent, but not really make a delinquent out of him simply?
Well, I'm describing it as merely symptomatic. Are you saying that there's nothing to worry about in comic books then, Mr. Wool?
Well, I worry about them, but I worry about them largely for the grounds that Mr. Wagoner gave. I think that there's something deplorable in a literature that teaches people brutalized behaviors, that puts them in a position where they regard social relations as aggressive and hostile, where violence is the most common recourse they have for the settlement of a dispute, and which generally trivializes all kinds of human beings and all kinds of human experiences.
Well, this is a pretty damning indictment, it seems to me. Would you agree with it generally, Mr. Weisberg?
Well, I think that as a matter of taste, that I would agree that the few comic books I've read in the last year or two, not because they may not be interesting, but because they don't tend to abound in large numbers on LaSalle Street, do not look like the best examples of literature, and I easily visualize parents very sensibly not wanting their children to read them on purely aesthetic grounds.
Well, you have touched briefly on the possible moral effect, and you've touched rather more strongly upon the question of taste. There is, it seems to me, too, the area of the more subtle psychological consequences of reading of this sort. And on a day when we are concerned about the possible traumatizing of our children by exposure to violent spectacles and so on, is there any importance to this point of view?
Well, only in this sense, that one in every four comic books is advertised by the publishers as a horror comic. So that horror is being purveyed, although again I revert to my earlier statement that it would be difficult to show a specific psychological effect accruing from a comic book that could not just as well be imputed to any of the mass media.
Well, you haven't given the comic book a clean bill of health, on the other hand, have you, Mr. Wall?
Again, I say on reasons of taste, but as I'm trying to separate out here the very common belief that a scientist in a white coat could presumably in a laboratory establish standards of specific effect from reading comic books. Presumably that if little Johnny saw someone being hung in a comic book, he might try and go out and duplicate it. And if he did so, it could be solely and completely attributable to the fact that he'd read about it in a comic book.
And yet, that is exactly the kind of assumption and the kind of argument that people have been making for several years now in favor of some very severe restrictions and control on the free circulation of this kind of literature to children.
But on the other hand, Mr. Weisberg, here is a phenomenon about which I think we all agree, at least to the extent that the American scene would probably be a good deal better off, by and large, without comic books. And it seems to me the most natural thing in the world is to say something ought to be done about this thing.
Well, that's precisely the issue. That is, I don't doubt that there are thousands of people who are indignant or worried or have a vague feeling of malaise about comic books. Granted, the real responsibility that seems to inhere in the discussion is for those people who feel bothered or annoyed to try and think out exactly what is bothering them and try to discover if their problems are genuine ones. Now, is there any knowledge that has been brought to bear to show specific harm accruing from comic books or specific good?
Apparently, many people and many people who make laws feel that there is such knowledge available because dozens of cities and states and legislative committees throughout the United States in the last 5 or 6 years have investigated the problem. Many laws have been passed, actually, which try to prohibit the sale of comic books and other kinds of literature with a great deal of horror and violence in it to children. Chicago, for example, is now considering in its city council the passage of an ordinance that would very broadly prohibit the sale of literature that exploits brutality and violence to children under 17.
Well, now, what would really be wrong with this? I mean, on the face of it, it would seem quite a logical procedure. That is to say, granted that you cannot attribute any specific effect to these things, that they are belong to a class of literature and of influence which is extremely diffuse. Nevertheless, anything you can do to limit the flow of this kind of stuff in the mass market would seem to be making a positive contribution to the well-being of all concerned. And particularly, since we're here dealing with literature designed especially for children, even though we know that it isn't confined in its reading to children, it would seem that we have a right to control it for the health of our children. Once they grow up, of course, they can be allowed to read anything and make their own judgments about it, but they are not responsible individuals when they're children. What would be wrong with this kind of effort?
Well, strange as it may seem, many of us feel that a very great problem of principle is involved. And the principle...
I think it's strange.
The principle that's involved is the principle of free communication, liberty of the press, and all of the ideas that are associated with the commitment to free communication of ideas. Now, I agree with you that probably no free speech problem as such is raised by the idea of putting restrictions on the circulation of literature to children. We don't tend to think that freedom to read what you will is quite the same kind of thing or has the same kind of importance for a child as it does for an adult. But to try to impose these restrictions on the sale of literature to children seems to raise problems for free speech for adults in at least two ways. One is that the standards that are always proposed are so vague that they inevitably, because of the threat of suppression and the threat of intimidation, lead people who distribute printed matter to impose the same kinds of restrictions on what they carry and what is available for adults.
Our society has made several rules about prohibiting children from certain kinds of activities which it's physically difficult to isolate them from. And nothing that would prevent a child from walking into a bar and asking for a shot of whiskey. In fact, our society does establish fairly good working rules that prevent minors from being served with liquor. It establishes all kinds of rules preventing minors from getting tobacco. This is not to say that the rules work invariably and in every case, but overwhelmingly they do.
I think
if you start with the assumption that no possible control is possible, what in effect you're doing is ruling out the search for some solution which may be feasible, but which has not yet occurred to anyone.
You haven't said, Mr. Weisberg, that no control is possible, have you?
No, I'd like to add that what Mr. Wohl says relates directly to the second problem that I referred to before, and that is that it just does not seem possible to spell out standards in the kinds of laws that people seem to want in this field that are definite enough so people know just what will be covered by them and what will not. As a lawyer, I tend to be preoccupied with the fact that the courts have had great difficulty upholding the constitutionality of laws which employ these extremely vague terms, and because of their very vagueness, impose restrictions far broader than are probably intended on the free circulation of literature to everyone.
See, I think this is a practical problem for investigation. While there are lots of people who are worried about this, we actually know, as a matter of fact, very little about what large majorities of people agree upon as inappropriate for children. Now, has anyone tried to find out, as a fact and empirically, what common grounds are established by people who want to control comic books for their control?
Well, the comic book industry itself has been very much concerned about this thing, and this suggests, by the way, another source of control other than legislation. Now, what have the comic book people themselves found out? They do have their taboos, and they do have their standards, don't they?
Well, I think they're suffering from a real shortage of taboos. I think they're suffering from precisely the difficulty in the sense that they're not entirely clear about what the major areas of objection are, because these objections have usually been phrased rather abstractly. I don't think anyone would approve of brutality or violence or hatred or sadism. But in concrete particulars, it's very difficult to say how exactly you change a drawing to wipe out the sadism.
I think there are serious problems about restricting any published material from circulation. It isn't like alcohol or cigarettes or some of these other things, because they are consumed, and published material circulates and gets around and stays around and maybe is not consumed physically, literally, in the same sense. It is therefore far more difficult to control. And besides, we know that you're dealing here with literature which is supposedly designed for children, is labeled for children, but is not, in fact, consumed entirely by children.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the alcohol and tobacco example that's always given in this connection is that it's not very hard for us to know what liquor is and what cigarettes are if we want to pass a law and say that children shouldn't be able to get them. When it comes, however, to literature that dwells on things that we find objectionable, whether there's the kind of consensus that Mr. Wohl speaks of or not, I think the problem is heightened by a brief mention of one of the most common kinds of control techniques that's utilized these days, and that's the boycott. Druggists in big cities who handle paper-bound books are by now very familiar with the picture of groups of housewives who come round, visit him with a list of books that they've gotten somewhere, which they say are objectionable. They ask him not to handle these books. And frequently, whether they're instructed to or not, make it quite plain that they propose to use their economic power in order to try to compel him not to handle these books. This is the type of subject matter that I think, in line with the taste problem that Mr. Wegener puts, emphasizes and brings home the fact that if we're really dealing with the problem of taste, then aren't we dealing with something that different people and different groups in our society tend to disagree about? And when they disagree, that, it seems to me, is the beauty of the principle of the free communication of ideas. We decide not to have any social controls that apply to everyone and that would permit one person or one group of people to inflict their tastes on everyone in the community.
Well, this raises the problem that I alluded to earlier. The fact that people differ in tastes does not necessarily mean that there are no standards of tastes of wide applicability. And this raises, I think, a point that had been mentioned earlier. One of the consequences of looking to laws for the control of this problem is an implied contempt that I deeply deplore of the influence of the home, of the school, of parents, of the intimate circle of friends. I don't see why we should rely so strictly on law, because law has shown, historically, a considerable inability to deal with this problem. It is an American characteristic, I think, whenever there's a problem, to pass a law. And if Chicago is going to try and pass a law to control comic books, I think we should remember that there is a law now on the municipal statute books that prevents people from leading a cow up and down Michigan Boulevard. No one tries to do this. This probably was passed in some hectic moment, too. What I think is at the heart of the issue is, do the people who feel uncomfortable about comic books and their contents really know what is bothering them? And if they do, haven't they great resources to counter the influence of comic books at home, in the school, in the church? Why only try to control the producer? Why not try to control the consumer a little? And here I think self-control is probably the biggest point. The prevailing assumption is that if you show a child a comic book, he succumbs at once to its charms and can't be wrenched away from it. I don't see why this necessarily should be so if there were people around him, his parents, his teachers, or his friends, who had a conception of taste, and I like Mr. Wegener's word, which would not only wean him away, but decisively draw him away from some of this literature that is deplorable on the grounds of taste.
No matter how I try to squirm out of this, it seems to me that you are imposing the ultimate responsibility in this case, not on the law, not on small groups, but upon all of us as parents, as teachers, and as citizens. For imposing this responsibility, by the way, I'm extremely grateful to all three of you, to Mr. R. Richard Wall and Mr. Charles Wegener, both of the faculty of the University of Chicago, and to our guest expert, Mr. Bernard Weisberg, attorney of Chicago. Now, this is Edward Rosenheim, returning you to Monitor in Radio Central.
New World Intelligence for Today, a scholarly look at the problem of the comic book. Next week, the effect of radiation on the generations of tomorrow, a subject of vital interest to an atomically oriented new world. And now, a non-atomic symbol for the special orientation of monitor stations.